quality time with you in a day than I do with anybody else.
You'll be sick of me.
What time? Good afternoon. It's 1 p.m. on Monday, February 7th. We're going to get started and once again open up our subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development Committee. With us is Robin Lamont, our LFO staff, and we're going to move right into the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Corey, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our agenda today in front of you, we were going to follow up on a few issues that were raised on Thursday. We have Lydia Muniz from the governor's advocate for minority women and emerging small businesses, who has a brief presentation to clarify some of the questions that were raised on Thursday. Raleigh Lewis can then answer any additional questions that you may have about his specific program, the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses within our department. The chair had then requested that Pat Allen come back today to respond to any further questions, so he is on next, and then that would bring us back to our regular order of business, the Central Support Services presentation, and then at your discretion, we are prepared to move into the discussion of performance measures and agency priorities. And whether we get through all of that today or not, we will see, but we're prepared to move as fast as you would like us to.
Terrific. I think, what do we have scheduled for tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they are still scheduled for tomorrow. If they wrap it up soon enough, you could make the decision. And, by the way, next week's agenda is on the backside of your agenda. We could ask Housing and Community Services to start on Tuesday or finish up with DCBS, whichever works out best.
Perfect. Well, why don't we do this? We're trying to move forward aggressively today. I'll ask the members to hold their questions unless it's absolutely imperative, and then during the breaks as we move from one person to another, then we can ask our questions then, and then I'll do my best to just keep the process moving forward.
Okay. So I think then we would start with Lydia, and I should mention also that we have provided you in written form with answers to some specific questions about this program that were raised last week concerning outreach to rural areas, outreach to non-English-speaking Oregonians, and some of the where the dollars are distributed.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lydia Muniz, and I am the governor's advocate for minority, women, and emerging small businesses. The mission of my office is to advocate for policies and promote programs that improve government business opportunities for minority, women, and emerging small businesses. And the statutory authority for the advocate's office can be found under ORS 200.025. And I'm not going to read you the entire statute. Certainly you can do that on your own. But I will highlight some of the major responsibilities that the advocate has. One is advising the governor and the legislature on activities and initiatives that promote the economic integration of minorities, women, and emerging small businesses into the marketplace. Listing accomplishments, preparing a report to the governor and to the legislature on the status of minorities, women, and emerging small businesses in the marketplace. Other duties that the governor may assign. And then I also have responsibility for oversight and administration of the Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse. And this is a statutory requirement of state agencies to notify the advocate's office anytime they have a contracting opportunity in excess of $5,000, and this is what we refer to as the clearinghouse when I speak about the clearinghouse. The advocate's office consists of two FTE, myself, and then also the staff person that manages the day-to-day operations of the clearinghouse. And just a little bit of history in terms of why the office exists, why the position exists, and I'm glad that Senator Carter was able to be here because I do want to acknowledge that she was one of the primary authors of this legislation back in 1987 that created the position and the office. And so certainly want to acknowledge Senator Carter for her role in that. I'm going to, from a historical perspective, refer you to ORS 200.015. And when I start talking about this, this will illustrate, I think, the reasons why back in 1987 the legislature felt that this was an important issue and an important reason to create the position and the office, and why it's still very important today. But under statute, it says legislative findings, that the legislative assembly supports the aspirations of minorities, women, and emerging small businesses to enter the mainstream of Oregon social, political, and economic life. The opportunity for full participation in our free enterprise system by minorities, women, and emerging small businesses is essential. Greater economic opportunities for minorities, women, and emerging small businesses is essential. And a review of public programs to remedy historical patterns of exclusion of and discrimination against racial or ethnic groups and women is needed. And then skipping down towards the end of that statute, a couple of other sites that are important to this discussion. It says, women and minorities are rebuttably presumed to be economically disadvantaged and socially disadvantaged. And as I speak to you today and offer some information about the program, I do have a packet of handouts for you. They are numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so when I get to that point in my testimony, I'll refer to the number so that you know what I'm talking about. And I've given that to the legislative assistant to provide for you. When we use the terms economically disadvantaged, socially disadvantaged, minorities, and emerging small businesses, or certification, these are all terms of art, and they are specific to the statutes that I've referred to the programs and services that we're going to be talking about today.
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Senator?
Yes.
Thank you.
What year did this become law? I guess I could lean over and ask Margaret, but we'll put it on the record.
Yes, Senator Westland, it was in 1987.
The
position and the office was created.
How long a period of time did it take for this policy to be implemented? I mean, in terms of the legislative history trying to get this passed through the session. Do you have any idea? Is that an unfair question?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I have only been in state government since 1989, so I would defer to, you know, Senator Carter, perhaps, or others that were around prior to that, I could get the information for you and bring that back to you.
Mr. Chairman.
I'll get with Mark.
Okay.
Please, Senator Carter.
I could answer the Senator. And Senator, we actually brought this bill about in 1985, but my legislative colleagues felt that this bill was not ready for law, and felt that we were just trying to expand affirmative action, and did not want this bill in law. Even though we had data, Mr. Chairman, that showed that contracting and other issues in state government was unfairly done, we still did not want to do anything about it, and people did not want to go on record for it. So it took us starting this bill in 1985 and at the wee hour of night getting it passed in 1987. So it was, I want you to know, there was a lot of bloodshed over this bill, so please know it was not an easy thing. And to Ms. Streisinger, who has been working very hard to make a difference in our state, I will tell you that there were buffers then, as I'm sure you're seeing buffers today. And this fight is still a hard fight to try to make a difference within state government, but yet trying we must still continue to do, and striving we must continue to do, and people must obey the law. And so I have found with this chairman and with this group that I think that we're going to see a difference in terms of people following the law and trying to make all Oregonians inclusive of this economic mainstream that we have. Does that answer you?
It does.
Thank you.
Since I'm sitting next to a living encyclopedia, I thought we should take advantage of it. A good-looking living encyclopedia.
As we go through this process, as you probably are aware, last week I was concerned about some of the activities that have gone on in this office. And the reason for my concern is that I view this as probably one of the most important offices in the state of Oregon for ensuring that all Oregonians have an opportunity to do business in the state of Oregon and with the state of Oregon. So as you go through your presentation and through the information you're providing us, can you really provide concrete examples of assistance that's been provided?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can, and as we follow through some of the testimony, I will make that information available. I do have some examples of some businesses that have been successful.
Okay. And I want you to know in this committee to know today is Oregon or Rural Oregon Day, and I'll be coming in and out. But every day I do get the recorded hearings, and I'll if I miss anything while I'm stepping away, I'll make sure that I watch that, and I'm sure if I have any questions, I'll follow up.
Mr. Chair, that would be great, and I'd be happy to also follow up with you and answer any other questions. Last week, as you heard from Mr. Raleigh Lewis, he presented you with information about the certification program, the different programs, the responsibilities, requirements for each of the programs under federal and state law. Today, what I hope to do is share with you what the Advocate's Office does for those businesses that are certified or are eligible to participate in these programs. The Advocate serves as the policy advisor to the governor on issues related to minority, women, and emerging small businesses. In that capacity, state agencies look to me to provide policy recommendations, leadership, advice related to how they fulfill the intent of the legislature as well as the expectations of the governor related to these programs. Briefly, the difference between the two offices, since we share very, very similar names, you're probably wondering what the difference is. Governor's Advocate's Office works with the governor and the legislature and is a policy advisor and sets recommendation. The Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Businesses, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, carries out the certification process. The relationship between the Governor's Advocate's Office and the Certification Office is a collaborative partnership. We share the same constituents, but we perform separate functions. Again, OMWESB processes the applications for certification. They make determinations on eligibility. The Advocate's Office takes it from there and provides the full range of added value services to those businesses. Now, the process for how the state determines who is socially and economically disadvantaged is through the certification process. That's the vehicle that currently we have in place as to how we make that determination. And last week, Raleigh Lewis discussed the process related to the certification responsibilities in his office for the three different programs that they certify for. He told you that for the DBE program, which is a federal program, there are federal regulations that they adhere to in processing and reviewing eligibility. For state programs, we have statute that outlines what businesses can participate. Now, referring back to the legislative intent that I spoke about under ORS 200-015, once a firm is certified, then they become my constituents. And now, who are my constituents? I have two sets of constituents. One would be internal, and that would be state agencies, the legislature, the governor, that needs policy guidance on these issues related to minorities, women, and emerging small businesses. The other would be my external constituents, and those are primarily the approximately 1,500 certified firms that have gone through the process in the state of Oregon through the certification program and have been deemed eligible to participate in one of those three programs.
Would it be possible to get a geographical breakout of where those 1,500 reside?
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be. We can certainly get that to you. I probably have somewhat of a breakdown today that I could offer to you, but we can get a more full.
Just by county would be.
Mr. Chair, we have a map which we can provide you as well.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to emphasize in talking about constituents that those are my, you know, primary, internal and external. But I do want to emphasize that no business that would contact me is ever turned away. But my role is to specifically advocate and provide services to those firms that are certified or meet the eligibility for certification.
Let me ask another question. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm asking these because of the issue I raised last week. How does a firm know to contact you?
Well, we have, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a website which probably provides one of the best list and links to you know, different information on procurement, on how to register your business. So they would come into the governor's website and to my office, and they'd be able to access some of those links.
Is that the sole way that you folks reach out to people to let them know?
Mr. Chair, we do provide outreach, and we do have a network of partnerships and, again, collaborative relationships that we maintain throughout the state. And so those partners know about our office, what we can provide. I typically will get, you know, in fact, last week, last Friday, I had a phone call from a woman that had been referred by the Small Business Development Center in Portland. Was just thinking about starting a business, and they asked her, had her call me and find out whether certification was something she should pursue. She didn't know how to go about registering her business, so I was able to refer her to the Secretary of State Corporation Division, give her some information on startup and that sort of thing. So we also would get it through some of our partners. Certainly the certification office directs phone calls and businesses to me as well to provide that information.
Can you send me a list of the partners so that way I can speak with them? I want to hear about the good things from them.
Certainly. I'd be happy to do that.
Senator Carter.
I just want to tell you, Mr. Chair, that one of the things that has happened in terms of trying to do good outreach is that the legislature has cut support staff, I think starting 4 or 5 years ago, to this office. And if you don't mind my speaking out loud, Mr. Raleigh, you can raise your hand. Do you have support staff in your office? Right. You have five support
staff.
One support staff, five certification staff.
Yeah. And how many in your office?
In my office, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we have two FTE, and I just recently was able to get some part-time support just like a week ago.
So let me ask another question, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So, because the question, the chairman is asking you a very forward question, and it appears to me that that's what he's asking.
It is.
Because the website is not going to do it alone. And so what he's saying is, how you have these other little phalanges going out to all these different communities over here talking about opportunities in helping to support small businesses, to help stabilize those businesses and help them to know about procurement opportunity and that kind of stuff. In your office, when you don't really have, and I'm trying to say, I don't think she has enough office staff to be able to go off and do that and come back in, and they do the work while you're out trying to get information out across the state because the legislature cuts staff. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to get you to say, but I don't want it to be against Corey, anybody else, it's against us, the legislature. That's Corey, why I'm trying to get the information. Because we, the legislature, cut you know, that kind of staff from these offices, and so therefore they're not made whole and cannot do what they used to do in terms of going out to the different communities.
Representative Richardson.
Just in kind of in line with what you're saying, Senator, there are things that can be done with current staff. For instance, I don't know if when someone files for an assumed business name or a permit, if they're notified of the existence of this program, and all they have to do is go on the internet to this website. I mean, mm-hmm. there may be ways that we could connect with individuals that are starting their business. How about when they file for a business tax ID number for the state?
Yeah, we call them. Maybe
we notify them at the time that they get that. That if they qualify, here's where they could go to find additional information, and it wouldn't cost much at all. I'm just thinking that maybe we can outreach in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, in fact, that is one of the probably the best ways to get information out. We do have a designation on the Secretary of State's website, so there's a link from them to us, and we also appear as both offices, the certification and mine, appear as resources in the publication business guide that the Secretary of State puts out.
Well, why don't we do this? I think it's very, very important that we work together on this issue. I think the service you provide is absolutely essential for the state of Oregon. And I do not direct my questions with the intent of being critical, but with the intent of trying to help and support and build up what you're trying to do. I've been educated a little bit today in the difference, and with that said, Raleigh, I apologize for the comments I directed at you last week. Lydia, I would like to work with you, because if you would have been here last week, I would have directed them at you. I think this is absolutely essential. I think we need to bring all of you to the table. Senator, I'd love to have you join me. Bring economic and community development in, and also the small business development centers, and let's figure out how to strengthen this very, very needed service to Oregonians who aren't being reached out to. So, and I'd like us to move along, because I think we could stay on this all day.
Mr. Chair, I do have the map showing certified businesses by county. If you would like to see it, we have copies to hand out.
That'd be terrific.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could just say, in front of you, you have the packet of attachments that I had brought to share with you. In that, you'll find some of the communications that we do get out to businesses, because we are a very small office, statewide program, only 2 FTE. A lot of our communication is through email, fax, and our website, but we have a newsletter that we provide to our businesses and partners that gets some of this information out to them throughout Oregon.
So, Mr. Chair, unless there are additional questions, Mr. Lewis is here to answer questions if you have them, but we would leave that up to you. If you have no further questions about this program area, we're also certainly prepared to move along.
I think the clarification between the two offices has been very helpful, and it sounds like Chair Smith has plans to continue this discussion outside of this hearing, so we can continue.
Okay. Thank you, and we look forward to those as well. Thank you. You had asked for Pat Allen from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining to come back briefly. Pat?
Yes.
And to follow up just very briefly on some of the comments that were made last week, and then again answer any further questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pat Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. As Corey says, I'm mainly simply here to wrap up and make sure questions or issues you had were addressed. And in the Thursday session, Chair Smith had expressed some interest in potentially having the license directory demonstrated for you. I'm prepared to do that today if you want. If, however, in the interest of time, you'd rather not take up your hearing time with that, I'd be happy to stay after today or to set up individual appointments with you at your leisure or your discretion on that point. And if not, then I just have a couple of wrap-up comments and answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Would you refresh your memory as to what are you referring to as far as the directory?
The license directory is the online directory of all 1,100 or so state licenses, permits, certifications. It's accessible to businesses or other interested people to be able to search and find information about what's required to be licensed to do a variety of activities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since they have it set up and I think it is of interest to the committee, I would recommend spending a few minutes and taking a look at it.
Okay.
If you like.
We won't necessarily need to go through all of them.
No, I can do this.
We'll hold it down to 900, shall we say?
We will teach you to ask questions.
Yeah, I guess the question, would you prefer them in numerical or alphabetical order?
Oh, please.
50,000-foot view will be good.
Bring the bond back.
Yeah, that's all right.
All right, this is the, when someone goes to oregon.gov/LIC, this is the license page that they find. I guess the first question is, this is a little bit small to fully fit the screen. Can everyone see it well enough at the type size that it's at? Basically, what you find here are some basic introductory pieces of information at the top. Right here in the very center is the basic search function, which is how...
Okay, just a moment.
Just a question about the web address.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that information out in public somewhere, or are you guided to this page once you get into the state web page?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, this complicated web address you see up at the top is not the page that anyone needs to remember or find
to
access.
That's the test you passed.
That's a redirect that goes to the actual server. But oregon.gov/LIC, and then on oregon.gov, you're able to find it. And actually, if you search on a typical search engine like Google for Oregon licenses, the first hit that will typically come up is to this directory. So
Right. There
are a variety of ways to get directly to it.
Thank you.
Outside this search box in the center on the left-hand side, you'll see a section called Applications Renewals Online. These are some of the licenses that are actually the licenses that are currently available for actual renewal online right now. And it's a variety of things, boat titles, landscape contractors licenses, mortgage lenders at the Consumer Business Services. This is a list that over time will certainly expand as agencies have underway now or have future plans for expanding it. The far right-hand side is a box called Popular Licenses, and this is simply drawn from a ranked list based on how people access the licenses. It's what people actually look for. And so, not surprisingly, things like assumed business names are right at the top of the list. This is rendered alphabetically for ease of identifying things, but it's the things that people most often look for. And in the center, there are just some links to typical resources, information from the Secretary of State on starting a business. A lot of people come here looking for motor vehicles information and so on. Let me just give you one quick demonstration of how one might use this to look something up. If you go into the search field and put in something like barbers, you'll end up...
I always hate when that happens.
Or not.
Take off the S.
No, I don't think that's your problem.
The question is, are you hooked up?
I was. Well, this
it happens to Bill Gates, too. You
fairly
know.
Mortifying.
Try Minority Women in Business.
The problem is, I don't think we got offline, apparently. So.
Oh, yeah.
I really promised that I came in here before 1 o'clock and tested this all the way out.
I think I'm going to have to
punt. What would come back would be then, if you put in just a common search word, tax or barber or accountant or whatever, is a list of any licenses where in the license title or the license description or anywhere in the text there was the use of that phrase. You'd then be able to read through the list of licenses that made that reference and find the one that you were looking for and then link to it. And I would sit here now and show you how all the information would display on that and how you do a search for licensees and those kinds of things. But I'm sorry, I can't do that evidently.
Do you want us to move on and you can fiddle with it and come back, or do you want to just...
We understand. It's okay.
Okay.
What is the situation with motor vehicles? Doing online licensing.
Motor vehicles, Mr. Chair, is actually one of the great examples of an agency that has used online licensing as a real tool. There are most functions which need to be done, particularly with respect to titling vehicles, those kinds of things. Those are able to be done online in parts of the state where you don't need DEQ certification. Right now, that function causes there to be the need for a paper function. But all trucking business, for instance, can be done online. It's a system that they have really driven down into what they do. Driver's licensing at this point cannot. My speculation would be that that's an area that will actually get harder to do as time goes by and federal legislation puts more restrictions on vehicle licensing. The only other thing I want to mention,
number of hits or how much it's used.
Yeah, we pull up. the number varies, but anywhere from 35 to 50,000 different pages of license information get pulled down from the system. It's difficult to tell how many people are doing that, but it's a large, large number of requests for information that come down from the system.
Okay, good.
And the only other brief thing I wanted to say before answering any other questions you might have is I think Senator Johnson last week asked a question that I don't think really got directly dealt with, which is, what does working with agencies mean, or sort of in short, what do we do? And just kind of the quick run through thinking about the discrete work functions that we do in the office. Training, designing and administering training for agency staff on issues like dealing with administrative rules and particularly economic and fiscal impact statements. Administrative rule review. I go through the Oregon Bulletin every month as it comes out and read every single notice of rulemaking from every state agency, identify those that look like they have a business impact, and then get copies from the agencies of the relevant materials, the statements of need and fiscal impact. And I go through those and figure out if it looks like they did the kinds of things that they need to do in that work, and then interact with an agency if I have questions or have concerns. We coordinate multi-agency projects. I talked about the small retailer combined licensing project last week, and we do the actual pulling everybody together in a room and helping them move through identifying the pieces of work and getting them done. Facilitating resources for agencies. For instance, we worked with one licensing board, radiologic technologists last year, that had some real need for some help with process improvement, and got them hooked up with someone who was able to work with the agency on how to improve their licensing processes. We share best practices with agencies through a variety of means. We've got our website has got some best practice material. We do a periodic email newsletter. We communicate our efforts and solicit suggestions. I talked about the paperwork reduction project we did. We highlighted last year that was in the form of a press event with the governor, with 250,000 sheets of paper saved stacked up in the ceremonial office to help draw some attention to that. We did a push version of our business climate survey, not so much to get scientifically valid responses back, but to get that survey and those questions in lots and lots of businesses' hands so that we could generate suggestions from that. We do technical assessments on call for agencies when they have specific questions about how to deal with particular issues. Legislatively, we performed a function during the legislative concept development season where we worked with agencies that were contemplating proposing new or expanded regulations and prepared a set of questions and issues that needed to be addressed for agencies to be able to move forward on those. And then we do legislatively directed work effectively. There are a number of legislative interim committee or legislatively created committees last session, one created by House Bill 3120, which I directly staffed, another created by House Bill 2011, which dealt with land use issues that I spent a fair amount of time directly involved in. That's maybe a little bit of a laundry list, but kind of a rundown to get at your question, Senator.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Well, that's very responsive, and I appreciate having it. The piece that's still missing for me when I hear the words regulatory streamlining is, where's the customer service piece to the citizens of Oregon? And I just jotted down as you read through your list, it's all rulemaking, reviewing rules, interacting with agencies, coordinating with agencies, facilitating resources for agencies, best practices for agencies. The only thing that seemed to touch on doing anything for the customer, Oregonians, was getting the business climate survey into people's hands. And I guess when constituents of mine hear the term regulatory streamlining, they're looking, perhaps as am I, for those things that your office would do to try to get agencies to get better in sync with each other so that the ultimate beneficiaries are a guy with a business in two different counties, and agencies have completely different interpretations of the rules with respect to, and I'm making this stuff up, septic tanks or setbacks or other compliance issues. And the piece I'm looking for is the reassurance that you all aren't just helping agencies be better bureaucrats, but you're helping the bureaucrats ultimately be better service providers to the constituents that they serve, the taxpayers.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, two points with respect to that, directly to the issue of customer service. I didn't include in the laundry list and perhaps should have. The dozen or so largest regulatory agencies we have do an annual customer satisfaction plan, basically focusing on looking at the businesses they regulate as customers, assessing those customers' satisfaction, identifying areas that need improvements and then giving me a plan each year for what are they going to do to fix those deficiencies. The second issue is that I do participate as part of the economic revitalization team along with Corey Streisinger, and we work on the issues that team raises in terms of interagency coordination. And then the third point is that we've in December announced and are now working on developing with the League of Cities and the Association of Counties a set of state and local government pilot projects, not so much in the vein of let's find an individual problem and go fix that problem that popped up, but looking at regulatory systems in particular areas of the state to figure out together how state and local government can make that system work better.
Mr. Chair, would you give me a little latitude to pursue this for just a second? Do you ever meet with the governor's economic revitalization team folks?
Yes. Corey is a member of the economic revitalization team, the directors, and we participate in those meetings and activities.
Because having sat in on a few of those meetings, I know that out of the, I bet I've been to half a dozen of them, maybe a few more, there seems to always be a laundry list of kind of problem areas that a little bit of push from in the case of the governor's revitalization, they're walking around with the governor's card in their pocket. But I'm trying to figure out when you've got these plans for improvement, who goes back and checks those? Who's sufficiently entrepreneurial in your department to say, boy, this looks like a recurring theme. DEQ has two different interpretations for septic tanks, and we keep seeing this over and over and over again. I guess I'm just looking for the reassurance that there's somebody sufficiently nimble to be running the trap line on making sure that the issues that are identified are resolved and that we're making progress from that point on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the office is me plus a quarter of an assigned support person. So I try to be as nimble as I can be in terms of participating in the economic revitalization team. Of course, the disadvantage is there are a bunch of regional people with the various agencies, so I'm not able to be as visible in the regions as those staff are, but that is the job that I try to fulfill is to, for instance, on the customer service reports, look for those trends, look and hold people accountable for what you say you were going to do last year and did you actually do it, and those kinds of issues.
Thank you.
Senator, I'm struggling with still trying to visualize Pat Allen and Nimble.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, another word might be assertive.
I take assertive. Assertive is a good word.
And I believe anyone who has dealt with Pat would probably apply that word. And part of what his role is in fact to make sure that agencies know that there is someone who will be assertively inquiring about making their business regulations more friendly to business.
Pat, you do a very good job on visualizing a big guy, nimble. So,
thank you.
I guess the only other question I'd follow up with is, where's the or else? It's been my experience in sitting in on some of those early governor's revitalization, and they were earlier the community solutions, that those folks that were on the ground and interacting with real people trying to do real things could very easily identify the problems. Where's the hammer? You find two agencies that once you get past the agency heads who are getting along very well at the economic revitalization team level, but you get down into a more entrenched middle management that says we've always done it this way, we're always going to do it this way. Who gives you your fangs? What do you use as powers of persuasion to get folks that don't naturally want to play well together to play well together?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, of course, the executive order directs that agencies need to work with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. That's, you know, as in terms of fangs, I guess those are fairly stubby fangs. The reality is, I've had this happen. You deal with an agency on an issue where you're dealing with line or management staff, and there's a lot of pushback to heading down a particular path. And to this point, sitting down with agency directors or getting involved with governor's policy staff and asking people to come in and talk about an issue in the governor's office has worked quite well as that kind of attention getter.
Good. Thanks.
Pat, how difficult would it be on that web page to put a section on how to do payroll?
Representative Smith, I don't think it would be difficult at all. I'm just sitting here trying to think, is there something off the shelf I know I could immediately point to? I think we could certainly put a link like that.
I'd really like to work with you folks on that. Again, one of the things I mentioned last week is I really think there's a disconnect on helping entrepreneurs hire that first employee, mm-hmm. and I think you might be just the right tool to try and help something like that along.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's an issue that we've certainly identified as well as a top problem, and right now most of the ways we've tried to deal with that are figuring out ways to provide information more quickly and in a more consolidated fashion to businesses, because the actual regulatory barriers themselves are quite difficult to figure out how to deal with.
Senator Carter?
But I just wanted you to put something else on the record, not on his issue. That one of the things, Mr. Chairman, I hope that that can happen is that businesses, that agencies that deal with the issue of procurement and agencies that sublet opportunities to members of the community, that they would use the Office of Minority and Women Business more effectively. And there have been some pretty terrible reports from our agencies on this issue, as if they're tired of it, they don't want it to come back, but yet they're not doing a damn thing about it. And I would like to see a pat on that end, because we're not doing well as a state, I should tell you that.
Right. I think that point's very well taken, and we're trying to get through just an initial proceeding, and then I really, really intend for us to get folks together and to try and pound through this issue, because I think you're raising a very important point.
If there's no further questions for Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're ready to have Greg Malkasian talk about our shared services.
Yeah, he is a pretty big guy to talk
to. He is.
Nimble? I don't think so.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Greg Malkasian. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm going to give you a fairly quick overview of the Central Support Services, which is a tab in your notebook for budget purposes. The Central Support Services is best described as shared services rather than the way we have a tab for budget purposes. They provide services to the divisions and programs within the department. These shared services have the same mission as the rest of the department, which is to protect and serve Oregon consumers while supporting a positive business climate. Everything the support areas do is aimed at either delivering services directly to Oregonians or making sure that the operating divisions can do so most effectively and cost efficiently. And also, all divisions within the department and programs are involved in determining what functions are most appropriately performed as a shared service. For that very reason, when we get to reviewing the prioritization document, you will not see a line item of central support services or shared services, because they are integral to the performance of each of the programs. We have allocated them out in the most appropriate way that we could determine to each of those programs, because they are so integral. The actual makeup of the shared services within the department include the Business Administration Division, the Information Management Division, and the Director's Office. Within the Director's Office, in addition to Grace Reisinger and myself and our direct staff, we have the Office of the Regulatory Streamlining, whom you just heard from, Pat Allen, a Communications Section, and the Personnel Services. The communication section is a shared services that assures that clear communication with our stakeholders that is vital to the success of every DCBS program is available to stakeholders so that they understand their rights and responsibilities and have resources available to help them achieve their goals. It's also incredibly important for the consumers and workers that we serve as well. The communication section helps DCBS program divisions and offices educate consumers, workers, employers, and regulated businesses by designing and editing publications, reports, brochures, posters, websites, and other informational materials. The section also designs forms that are used to collect the information required for the divisions to conduct businesses. You've received some examples of some of those forms today in our responsive letter related to the Office of Minority Women Emerging Small Business, and then in the handouts that we provided each of you when we try to visit with each of you in your offices, there are more brochures that are relevant to the programs that we conduct. The Office of Personnel Services provides direct services to our divisions related to personnel management, training, safety, and efforts to achieve affirmative action goals. For example, one of our performance measures is to provide service to our customers in a manner where they rate their performance or their interaction with us at the highest possible level. And this could be viewed as a significant challenge for a regulatory agency. So we looked at how we might best be able to do that, and we determined that we may need to tailor specific workshops on customer services to meet division-specific needs. And we have conducted some of those workshops, and as you'll see when I talk a little later related to that performance measure, it shows that over 58% of those respondents rate their experience with us at the excellent category, which is the top category, while 93% rate us above average or better. The Office of Personnel Services efforts in the area of safety in the workplace have been very beneficial for our agency overall in reducing workers' compensation loss, time loss claims. They've been very effective in that area. They have also assisted all of our divisions in their efforts to increase diversity within our programs and our workforce through our Affirmative Action Program. We have increased our outreach to diverse community and professional organization, and our focus as of late in order to address this important issue has been more to strengthen our relationships and promote the department as well as the state as an employer of choice. Our Business Administration Division primarily handles our financial affairs. In addition to internal financial and accounting shared services responsibilities, they provide several of the other direct support shared services for divisions like cashiering, purchases, and collection. Corey mentioned on the first day that we were here about the subcommittee's support last session and the legislature's passage of a bill that granted the department warrant authority as a tool to enhance our collection efforts. We credit that authority to additional collections of over $800,000 in past due accounts during the past year. This represents a 7.5% increase in biennial collection activity based upon a comparable 18-month period of the last biennium.
Have you an estimate of what the cost was in order to generate that additional recovery?
Mr. Chair, the actual cost, I would need to get back to you. I know that we did purchase some software that enabled us to be more effective in the collection activity, but the actual execution of warrant authority would be fairly minimal, I believe, because it's a matter of the appropriate service of the required service to achieve the service of the warrant. And that I could get back to you on the specific.
There weren't additional FTEs or positions?
Mr. Chair, there were no additional FTE or positions added for this benefit that was accrued.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The next and the final shared service activity is the Information Management Division, and it also touches every employee and enhances our ability to achieve our goals. In addition to designing and developing and maintaining our data processing applications, which unfortunately you saw here today didn't work quite too well, but I think it's really the internet connection rather than our application. And they also provide technical and administrative support for computer hardware, software, and data communication system. One of the other key elements of the Information Management Division is the collection and analysis of information, which I hope you've seen as a benefit to you to provide in what we provided you here over the course of the last few days to make your decision. They're extremely helpful for our department managers as well as policymakers like the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which John Schultz spoke on briefly the other day related to the Workers' Compensation Division. We also implemented an online license application and renewal system, which we spoke earlier about providing five new license types for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and the Building Codes Division to apply and renew licenses online. We were successful in obtaining enterprise-wide authority for a specific software product, My License and License 2000, so it's available to other state agencies as well. And we hope to use with that same software to expand this availability to businesses in Oregon in 80 different license types over the course of 2000. One of the agency performance measures that we have is to increase the percent of customer transactions completed electronically, and we'll touch on that a little bit in the performance measure discussion as well. And streamlining these transactions makes it much easier to do business with our department while also enhancing customer service. And I want to point out that certainly this does not change the fact that people can license the usual way of filing a form or whatever the requirement may be. As a matter of fact, some of the processes that we have used have made that less cumbersome for our customers as well. But we've been particularly successful in this area, increasing the number of transactions completed electronically from 17% in 2002 to nearly 31% in fiscal year 2004.
Has that resulted in economies?
Mr. Chair, that as a matter of fact, it creates a level of extra work for us because we are still providing the benefit to those customers that choose to file through a normal record, a paper process, but we also provide the electronic process as well. So initially, it's even more cumbersome, but we believe that it accrues a significant benefit to the user of the system, and that enhances our customer service to the Oregon business using the electronic process.
Well, I assume, though, that although it would cost money initially to get it up and running, but if you are decreasing the amount of individual contact you need by 16%, I assume that you're saying went from 17% to 33%, then that means that you wouldn't need the same personnel to be doing the individual contact, dealing with hard paper and so forth, that of those that are coming in electronically, and so it seems like there should be some reflected savings.
Mr. Chair, over time, we actually are anticipating that. I don't know exactly where that break-even point is. I know in one area, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, we were able to actually receive 60% of certain securities filings through electronic data interchange, and that allowed us to reduce one support person. So in some cases, we've achieved that. In other cases, we have not achieved it yet, but we're certainly hoping that we'll benefit from that.
Okay, that's great. Mm-hmm. Just ask you, you said it was 60%. What was it before you went to electronic? I mean, or maybe in, I don't know how long it's been electronic.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, before it went electronic, we did not offer that. They were filed by paper.
Okay, and so how many employees would you have had doing it by paper? Because if you had two and you went to 60%, that makes sense. If you had eight and you went to 60% electronic and now you're down to seven, then that would indicate that maybe there isn't as much of a savings. And I don't mean to drill down too much. What I'm trying to get at is whether or not the advances being made with technology are being reflected in a lower overhead to the taxpayers.
Mr. Chair, actually, whenever we have a change of operation with the department, we're very careful to analyze the impact and see if there is a demonstrated benefit to in the way we are operating to reduce the staffing. In that case, it was done, and we're certainly hoping that we'll achieve that in other areas as well.
I know we're not in a position, of course, to do audits, but we can do a little spot check. Would you provide us with the information on the filing for securities, where you're now at 60%? I'd like to see for the last, how many years has electronic been involved?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's fairly recent, within the last year or two, but we can certainly get you that information. And when I said 60%, it was 60% of only one type of filing. So we'll try to get you the more specific detail that could help you with that.
Okay, but over that would be over the last 5 years, what the number of filings that have taken place, the number of employees that you have that process, those kinds of filings, and then you know, when electronics took place, so it would also be the number of filings that are now that are being handled electronically, just so we can see a relationship just in that, kind of focusing on that one area. Could you just provide that to us?
Certainly, we'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. And so that pretty much summarizes where we are with the department activities in, from a shared service perspective. I did want to highlight one other area, and that is where we work externally with on an enterprise basis, and we've been very active as one of the 12 state agencies that will be involved in the computer network infrastructure consolidation project, which is the data center consolidation. In working with them, we sat on the on several of the subcommittees to assist in providing information to assure that that planning was done efficiently and effectively as well. So that concludes my remarks on the shared service area.
Thank you. Comments or questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed your approved positions and FTEs declined fairly dramatically, but I would and I would compliment you, but I would suggest maybe you go back and check the math, because I don't think they declined quite as rapidly as what your chart shows here, at least by adding the numbers here for 0305. So I just picked up a mathematical error there.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, two things. Overall, our FTE count this biennium, as opposed to last biennium, is down 16.5 FTE. You do see a larger drop reflected in the shared services because of a shift in how some positions are allocated. There is a unit of staff who work on assessments that are specific to the Workers' Compensation Division. If you look at the Workers' Compensation System, you will see a corresponding increase in FTE there. That is not a change. It is a move. So there is a decrease in FTE overall agency-wide by about 16.5 FTE, and a number of those are in the shared service areas, but you are correct, it is not as big as it looks like if you just put the two shared services numbers side by side. Yes, I should mention the Injured Workers Ombudsman and Small Business Ombudsman also, for budget purposes only, because they provide services uniquely within the workers' compensation system, are now being shown as part of the workers' compensation system budgeting.
Thank you. There's a follow-up. Your first page of shared services, you might just look at those numbers and see if they're consistent, and as they then carry forward into your governor's recommended budget, because I'm not sure they're consistent. So just take a look at it.
We will double check.
Thank you very much. We'll do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I believe the next item on the agenda is to review our performance measures. And the performance measures are in your appendix, and tab B is the annual report. And it might be easiest to, when I start going through each of those performance measures, is go to tab B, and then page 4 is the first performance measures.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before Mr. Malkasian starts, I have handed out to you a series of questions that LFO has put together on the performance measures based on the review with the co-chairs, based on the LFO review. I wanted to be very clear. These are not critiques of the performance measures. They are clarifications, questions that came to mind. A number of questions, which, by the way, I have already provided to the agency. This isn't a surprise to them. A number of the questions are really phase two questions, but I provide them to you just in case they may help guide any of the discussion.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Little bit of background on our performance measures might be helpful to you, and then I'll try to touch on each one, and we'll discuss each of those. But consistent with our enterprise business planning and decision-making at DCBS, all of the division administrators and deputies, the Workers' Compensation Board Chair, as well as specific staff in the director's office, developed both the approach and the specific measures which we presented to the subcommittee last session for adoption and received your feedback, and we made, I think, one or two adjustments to them at that time. We also, as a group, regularly evaluate the performance measure progress. As we stated throughout our presentation, our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. And so we identified three fundamental goals drawn from this mission to guide our department activities. And they are to protect consumers and workers in Oregon, to regulate in a manner that supports a positive business climate, and be accountable to the public we serve with excellent service to our customers. So each of our measures represents key activities within the department that are measurable and serve one or more of the three goals. Some of the performance measures link directly to Oregon benchmarks, and those benchmarks are benchmark number 9, which is Oregon's rank in the cost of doing business, and benchmark 54, which we only have one measure focused on, which is percent of Oregonians without health insurance. We've actually learned considerably during the course of the last 2 years on management of these performance measures. And it's amazing the number of questions, as Robin has indicated. She's come up with several very good questions about them that focus on the complexity of the data that supports some of the measures. These lessons learned were actually the basis for our request to you this session on modifying of some of the measures. Our requests were considered and approved by the Oregon Progress Board and the Department of Administrative Service, and they're now before you for your consideration. And I will highlight those specific issues as we talk about each one of the measures. So under the appendix and tab B, page 4, you'll see measure number 1. And it is the percent of regulated entities operating in compliance with governing laws and regulations. It's a composite measure, and when I use the term composite measure, it means that more than one division or more than one activity within the department are included and contribute to the data of this measure overall. In this instance, the Department of Finance and Corporate Securities and the Workers' Compensation Division monitor compliance of businesses they regulate and determine compliance rates. Our regulatory activities protect Oregon consumers and workers by assuring the safety and soundness of financial institutions and timely and accurate delivery of benefits to injured workers. Performance is measured based upon objective audit and examination data. For instance, when we examine state chartered banks, we apply standards of measuring the soundness of that bank consistent with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and these standards rate the banks in 5 different categories. Only institutions rated in the highest 2 categories are considered as meeting an acceptable level of soundness. The others warrant a higher level of oversight. In this particular measure, we're requesting a modification. It has no impact on the past, present, or future data. Our concern is whether we're effectively communicating what the measure really signifies. People looking at the data may construe that those businesses not operating in compliance are operating illegally. That is not the case. Our latest performance data for this measure shows 83.5% of the regulated businesses are operating at desirable levels of acceptability or soundness. The majority of the remaining 16.5% are not operating illegally. However, because of their risk profile determined by the overall rating assigned, they generally present a higher level of concern and may require more than normal oversight. So we believe a better way of communicating the intent of the measure is merely to change the title. And so it would change from the existing measure language in the book here to percent of regulated entities operating at desirable levels of acceptability or soundness. And that is the summary of the first measure. The second measure on the next page is percentage of difference in wage recovery for workers who use return to work programs versus workers who do not. And John Schiltz talked a little bit about this measure during his workers' compensation overview. It addresses the question, are return to work programs helping workers? The results show that injured workers who use return to work programs achieve a higher rate of wage recovery. And right now, it's at 14 percentage points, and this shows not applicable for 2004. We just got that data in, and it continues to be at 14 percentage points now. Generally, these workers return to work sooner and reduce workers' compensation costs as well. This is a benefit to the worker as well as the employer.
Let me ask a couple questions.
Certainly.
Is there a method in which we would be able to take the data you provide us and compare it with other states of similar attributes? How do we know the data being provided to us is good, bad, or indifferent?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if other states have this data. We could check on that, but of course each state has a different way they approach the workers' compensation system overall, and this represents return to work programs which they may not have. So it could be a challenge in that it would likely be an apples to oranges comparison, but the actual data that we use is from the employment division, and we sync it up using Social Security numbers for the worker that was injured, and then 13 quarters later we look to see what the aggregate wage is for those same workers. It represents about 96% of the total number. We're able to make that connection and show that comparative difference. And we take that from workers that have used the return to work programs versus those that have not, and we compare it, and that is the difference, the 14-point spread.
Thank you.
The next performance measure, number three, is the percent of confirmed insurance complaints resolved with relief to the consumer. And Joe Ariel spoke to this measure earlier. It supports our goal of protecting Oregon consumers by assuring there's a mechanism for obtaining an advocate in complaints against insurance companies. Our consumer advocates work on behalf of Oregonians who feel they've been wronged. As you can see, the performance is currently above target at 70.8%.
Mr. Chair.
Sandra Johnson.
I may need some help with this from the professional staff. Robin, you had a book the other day that you were passing out that had tabulated survey results in it.
Yes, I have it in my office. I did not have it with me.
It may be relevant as we move along here. But it seemed to me that that had a huge number of people who were dissatisfied with the result that they got in the workers' comp arena. And I'm trying to reconcile that against this very narrowly defined performance measure of percentage of confirmed insurance complaints resolved with relief from the consumer. And I will readily admit that I just scanned that survey book, but it seemed replete with complaints. And I'm trying to reconcile that with a 70% approval when customers apparently are telling you they're not very happy. And help me understand what I maybe don't understand here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the documents that we sent out were examples of surveys in workers' compensation and I believe building codes, and they were the customer service surveys that were sent out. Many of those are actually surveys to regulated entities that we regulate rather than consumers. And the other thing that that those statistics show is we were asked to actually rate those that rate us at the highest level of customer service. And and I think overall, we'll be talking about that when we get to measure number 8, but that is actually lower, the people that are willing to give you that highest rating. But if you look at above average or better, the top two ratings, which isn't provided in those documents, you'll see we're pretty close to a 93% satisfaction rate. Does that help?
No. I must be completely confused. You want to take another shot at it, Corby?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, this particular performance measure is not related to the workers' compensation system. This particular performance measure is related to the insurance division's handling of consumer complaints in other insurance lines. Now, we can come back to the workers' compensation one, but this particular one is not a workers' compensation measure.
Okay, I just, when it said confirmed insurance complaints resolved with relief for the customer, I just obviously didn't nuance it that much, and I would very much like to go back to whatever performance measure you have that ties you to these surveys. For example, if I'm reading this one correctly, the claimant attorney survey that has very low ratings.
If you look at independent medical exams, it's horrific.
But maybe you can link these up as we move forward. I don't want to bog us down here if we're talking about your measure number 3 that has nothing to do with workers' comp claims.
That's correct.
That's correct. We'll come back to those when we come to overall customer satisfaction, if that's okay.
Good. Okay. So the next measure is number 4. And number 4 is the number of Oregon medical...
Senator Johnson.
I do want to just chew on this for a second longer. If this data is to be relevant to a layperson, just coming in and saying, how well is this agency doing? Without your explanation, how should I have known that when it just says percent of confirmed insurance complaints, how would I have known to separate the workers' comp from this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you absolutely could not know that by looking at the one sentence description of what this measure is. And that is why the Oregon Progress Board has given instructions to provide an annual performance report. And you really have to almost read an entire page. And then we even felt challenged to communicate the information that would be helpful to Oregonians who are reading this to even get it to fit in one page. It's a significantly difficult. But that page does talk about the specific data that is being used and the division that provides that data. But then you would also need to know that we're talking about mostly, as Corey said, other lines of insurance, not workers' compensation.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Please, follow up.
If, in the main, these performance measures are unintelligible to describe what it is. I mean, you just said it, that there'd be no way you could understand this without reading it, without having the explanation. Why are we tracking something that's so hard to explain?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the actual initial guidance we received in developing the performance measures a few years ago was to actually identify intermediate outcomes that could be discretely related to a particular activity. So it's an issue of accountability rather than a tangential relationship to a much broader outcome. And so actually these performance measures, I believe, are more helpful for internal management purposes of the agency assessing its actual performance in specific areas within the agency itself.
One more.
Please.
Then what does this page tell you? You're as internal to the organization mm-hmm. as you can possibly get. When you read this, what does it tell you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I know more than what's on this page, so that's kind of unfair. But what this tells me that those people that call our consumer section in the insurance department and have a problem with the way their claim for their automobile accident or their household insurance claim is being handled, and the explanation that they've given our consumer's advocate in the insurance division seems to be generally plausible, then that's probably a confirmed complaint. And then our consumer advocate interacts with the insurance company to address that issue. Oftentimes, that results in hearing another side of the story. And so sometimes it becomes a situation where when you hear both sides of the story, it is a one side saying something different and we cannot actually resolve it. But oftentimes, in 70.8% of the time, that interaction with our consumer advocate resulted in an outcome satisfactory to that consumer that had called in with a complaint.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be making notes of issues that we may want to come back to in work session. We may want to direct the agency to clarify that this particular performance measure does not deal with workers' compensation, or make some other clarification that will make any of these performance measures clearer. So as we get to these things, if members would please note it, then I will keep track of it as a work session item.
And the subtext to that is move on.
No. With all due respect,
she's good.
No, with all due respect, Representative Smith and Senator Johnson, I think that an in-depth review of these performance measures at this point is critical. And so, no, I really am not recommending that you move on. I am recommending that we discuss areas where we may want to come back. We are not in work session at this point, but we may want to come back in work session and request that they make these changes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would also be happy to meet with any interested members on a more informal basis where we can chat about these because they are extremely interesting. Number four is the number of Oregon Medical Insurance Pool enrollees. And Rocky had explained this measure previously during his discussion. Measure five is the number of claims against employers without workers' compensation coverage per 1,000 claims. And here what we're trying to achieve is getting a measure of whether or not we're actually having an effect of lowering the number of non-complying employer claims versus the claims where there is coverage by a workers' comp insurer. And then the next performance measure is number six.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, I was busy talking to the chair of the committee. One issue that the co-chairs raised and that I just wanted to point out to the subcommittee is that this measure is a key component of a statewide goal, which is to reduce the number of Oregonians without health insurance. And there's certainly interest in having in looking at a way of combining those pieces of data into a higher level combined kind of outcome. In the case of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the goal is to increase the number of enrollees because that reduces the number of uninsured Oregonians. But it's not exactly clear how this interacts with other efforts by the state, and so it's something that we may want to come back to.
And Mr. Chairman, I
please, Senator Morris
would also raise the question of, you know, is this really a performance measurement of the agency? I don't think it's appropriate. It's important to measure, but in terms of performance, it's beyond your control.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, in many respects, that's correct. It is a measure of output, if you will, or a prediction of output. But there are influences that the agency can have. One of the phenomena that we noted during this past year was that as premiums increased, as they are throughout the medical care field, enrollment started to drop because our surveys showed that, in fact, the plans were simply becoming unaffordable. So one of the actions that the agency took was to do a benefit redesign to offer an array of programs, some of which are priced considerably lower, and we're already seeing enrollment start to move up. So it is useful to have as a policy goal what has been articulated, which is that one of the goals is to provide more insurance to more Oregonians, because that gives us a directive that, in fact, if we see enrollment start to decline, not for lack of need but for other factors, we need to scratch our heads and see if there's something we can do to turn it back around. So it's mixed.
I would agree. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Malkasian again. And I breezed through number five. Should I touch on that again or just go forward number six now?
Please just.
Okay, I'll go on six. Performance measure number six is the percent of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits, and it's another workers' compensation measure. And our most recent data shows that 90.6% of the benefits processed by insurers and tracked by our department are accurate and timely, and that's an important benefit to Oregon workers.
Let me ask a question.
Certainly.
What happens to the other 9.4%? They're not receiving timely and accurate?
Mr. Chair, the other 9.4% actually are those workers that did not receive it within the standard that we have applied. And we apply a specific standard that they, in a number of different areas, that they will receive it, or the standard of accuracy. It doesn't mean they didn't receive it. They didn't receive it within that standard.
So what happens if someone's significantly hurt and in need of service, and they're unfortunately part of that 9.4%?
Mr. Chair, John Schultz is here today, and this is his division, and it might be very helpful for him to respond to that.
Perhaps you could shed some light on what happens to that 9.4%.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division, and it's spelled S-H-I-L-T-S. Thank you for the opportunity to be here again today. That 9 or 10% or so workers who do not either receive their benefit accurately or timely have, as Greg pointed out, they do receive their benefit. It may be untimely. It may be late. They may receive it, and it may not be the accurate amount. So when that happens, if the worker has the ability to come to the division and request a penalty against the insurer when that happens, and it is part of the statute ORS 656-262 sub 11, and we refer to those as 26211 penalties. If the insurer is found unreasonable in their delay of compensation, then a penalty is paid to the worker equal to 25% of the amount of the benefit that was due.
How often does that occur?
Mr. Chair, I would have to go back and get you the number of penalties that we issue. I probably have it here if you bear with me for a second. Yes, I do.
Squatter's rights.
Oh, I apologize, Mr. Chair. I thought I did have it, and I don't. I will get that information back to you and the committee tomorrow. It's frequent enough that we have regular sanction, what we call sanction investigations, going on all the time with insurers. We do enjoy a very high level of compliance here in Oregon. The amount, those numbers in the high 80% or the 90% would be the envy of most states in the nation. Most workers' compensation systems do not enjoy the level of compliance that our insurance companies and self-insured employers reach here in Oregon. But we do think that the penalties and the audits and the oversight helps keep that level high, and insurers and self-insured employers know that if they're late or they provide an incomplete benefit, that they're likely to get called on it and that they will be paying additional.
Well, I appreciate your oversight on that. To me, it would seem someone who's been physically injured, the last thing they need is then the trauma of the emotional, perhaps, of not getting the financial care they need, knowing that their family and is dependent upon them.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right, and the accuracy is important. Obviously, they don't want to be shorted on the benefit, but the timeliness is also just as important, and I don't want to overlook that. Knowing that that check is going to be there every Thursday afternoon in the mail or whatever day they expect it's going to be there is very important to the workers as well.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this statistic include the disputed employer disputed claim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, this does not include work claims that are deferred, so to speak, because the claim is has not been accepted yet. And the benefits are not yet due in certain circumstances, whereas wage replacement benefits are due. So let me start again and say the benefits that would be due in a disputed claim, yes, this would include. It does not include all of the benefits because not all of the benefits are due when the claim is in a deferred status.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Just raise the point that not all claims are necessarily legitimate, and that needs to be factored in to this metric. And determining what those are, I mean, that's hard to do, but that needs to be recognized.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we set standards as well in terms of our audits to determine when we would issue a penalty in terms of claims not being accepted within the 60-day time frame. The law says that the insurer or self-insured employer has 60 days in which to make the decision to accept or deny the claim. If the insurer or self-insured employer does not do that 100% of the time, we do not issue a penalty. The standard is set less than 100% because we know there are going to be some extremely difficult claims to decide, and there will be some claims that will go over 60 days. However, when it becomes a chronic pattern and when there are quite a few claims that go over the 60 days, there will be a penalty.
The performance measure number 9, which talks about the affirmation by an appeal to the judiciary at 96.5% for 04, you know, indicates one of two things. Either the appeals board and the judiciary are in cahoots, or that the appeals board, I mean the workers' comp board, is doing a good job in making sure that their factual basis for the determination is correct. And then, of course, it's the injured worker who's not happy with the outcome that has the appeal, but with such a high affirmative opinion on appeal, it looks like there has to be some relevance between the evidence and the decision. Now, it'd be also good to see what the client satisfaction was, you know, as in balance with this. But I'm just saying that that statistic certainly speaks well of workers' comp.
Mr. Chair. I want to make sure that I think that your statistics are reflecting what Senator Moore said, but correct me if I'm wrong. Regardless of the merits of a claim, an insurer has got to accept or deny the claim within 14 days. If they don't, they have to pay whatever compensation is due, the time loss, until they do deny the claim. And this would simply reflect whether or not they are abiding by that standard, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, that is exactly correct.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next measure is number 7, the number of Oregon employers who have voluntarily implemented outstanding safety and health programs. And when Mr. DeLuca was here last week, he mentioned how important it was to have a partnership with the industry and business in Oregon, especially to assure that we're achieving more self-sufficient businesses in Oregon when it comes to safety. We have two programs under this measure, and our effort here is for continuous improvement, to continue to build the number of firms in Oregon that participate in those programs that lead to self-sufficiency. Number 8 is our percent of DCBS customer surveys rating their experience with the department at the highest level. And this is a measure that includes a number of different divisions with and programs within DCBS. And as you could tell from the size of the notebook, which only includes some of these surveys, includes a number of different surveys. And we were asked by this committee last session to rate the performance at the highest rate, which you'll see is at 58.1% at this time. We have been somewhat tracking the satisfaction rate at above average and better, and that's more in the range of 93%. Measure number 9.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, did you want to ask a specific question about workers' compensation satisfaction? And I said we'd come back to it when we got to this measure, and I didn't know whether you'd covered it since through looking in the material.
Robin frightened me so badly I wasn't going to ask.
We'd be happy to talk with you separately as well if you prefer.
Actually, as long as you've opened the door, do you want to speak to that issue? It's fine with me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, in the workers' compensation area, you've received a whole set of different surveys, some of which deal with customer satisfaction with the performance of the department. Also, some specific surveys, which may be the one you've referred to as specific survey responses from claimants' attorneys, which were a part of a very specific data gathering project relating to the use of what are sometimes called independent medical examinations and sometimes called insurer medical examinations. That was a major study topic of ours this year, and there were significant issues, concerns raised, and we do have a major legislative proposal coming forward to address it. So, yes, there were definitely some concerns raised in that specific topic and ones that have produced some legislative proposals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Measure number 9 is the percent of workers' compensation board decisions affirmed on appeal to the judiciary, and I think Representative Vakian explain this measure better than I could. But bottom line, current performance demonstrates the ability of the board members to appropriately apply the laws consistent with the statutory mandate and thus minimize the cost resolving disputes for parties involved. Measure number 10 is the percent of timelines for key department activities that are met. And this particular measure is, again, a composite measure of a number of activities within the department. And it represents the timeliness and responsiveness of staff who work on such things as complaints, inquiries, license applications, renewal requests, new charters, branch offices, you name it, a number of areas. And one thing of special note for this measure is there are aspects of it that are self-imposed. What we try to do is to determine not just whether or not we're doing it timely with respect to statutory requirements, but whether or not improved service delivery in these areas are important to our customer, and if so, then we try to set our standards so that we actually deliver faster than the statutory requirement may be.
How do you track percent of timelines for key department activities that are met? Give me an example of how you do the math.
Okay. Mr. Chair, let me grab one. In one of these measures is whether the timeliness for Division of Finance and Corporate Securities complaint processing are met. And we have a standard, and if we take the total number of those complaints that are received, and we take how many of those were done within that timeline, then that's what this measure demonstrates. So in that particular instance, 91.9% of those complaints were considered timely. So you could.
How did you get the timely part? I understand being taken care of, but how do you get the timely section?
Mr. Chair, that's either statutorily defined or internally defined. If we look at that measure and we believe it's important to our customer to resolve something more quickly and it's achievable within our budget to do so, we attempt to crank down a little bit and try to perform that faster than or more timely than what a statutory requirement might be.
Let me rephrase this. And the reason I'm asking this, colleagues, is I want a little 101 here. I want to know how these performance measures are working. So I'm an employee of a business. I call in. Is at that point the clock ticking? And then when the issue is resolved in a final solutions letter is mailed out, is that when the clock stops and you measure that period of time to determine timely?
Mr. Chair, on that specific measure, the one that Mr. Malkasian just read you, that is a timeline for a first substantive response, not resolution of the entire complaint. We feel it's important, among other things, and the resolution of the final complaint is one of those other things, but among other things, someone deserves to know very promptly that we have gotten their complaint, it is being processed, and what the next steps will be. And so that is a first response.
How do you track?
We count.
The length of time. You count the days?
We log on that specific one. We can ask Mr. Lanter if we need more detail, but generally speaking, we would log something in and log the next step. If we have an issue, for example, about how fast we process a license, we know when we receive the application, we know when we issue the license, and we count.
And so then you would be able to tell the committee on average the length of time it takes from start to finish.
Mr. Chair, we should be able to, but we'd have to go measure by measure if you want that. There may be some where we do know that. There may be some where we do not.
One last question, then I'm going to go to Representative Richardson. While I see the value of doing this, I'm also wondering how much time is wasted by your staff calculating that. And I'm struggling with having efficiency while at the same time having you folks chase a bunch of numbers that all of us up here are scratching our heads over trying to figure out what they tell us.
Mr. Chair, Greg Malcasian again. Actually, that was one of the very issues that was of concern to us when we as a management team got together and discussed what standards we would apply. And one of our interests was to minimize the amount of effort that it takes to actually collect the data. So we look to see if within our system, is the system automatically capturing this data or is it easily captured? And we tried to address those things where it did not become a considerable workload in and of itself to track that data. And hopefully in many of them, it is actually something that actually gets registered into the system. And then when an action is taken, that's entered into the system and it's calculated. So it doesn't take a tremendous amount of effort, hopefully, in many of these cases.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, also, Mr. Malcasian, what is the percentage of cases in Oregon that are appealed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, are we talking about the specific workers' comp board changes that are appealed with respect to Measure 9 that we were discussing earlier?
Well, looking at Measure 9, I see that Alaska has 13.2 appeal rate, California has 25, Nebraska has 31 case. That's the appeal rate, number of cases appealed, not the number that are affirmed after they are appealed. I'm just wondering, I don't see a number for Oregon's. What percentage of our cases are appealed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I was looking in or past the information that there are actually 800 board reviews requested, but that doesn't actually answer your question. The issue is, of 800 board reviews requested, how many would then be board decisions would be appealed? We would need to get that information, and I'm sure it's readily available, and we could have it to you tomorrow.
Okay, I'd like to have that, since it is a compare. We have actual data of other states, and it'd be nice.
Certainly.
Nice to see.
That's a very good point. Okay. So I've gone back to 9, and now I'm to measure number 11, I believe. And measure number 11, we've actually talked about on a couple occasions in the shared services area, and also I believe Pat Allen spoke of it. But bottom line here is we are looking at the percent of customer transactions that are completed electronically. So if a transaction can be done electronically, what percent of them are? And as we mentioned earlier and last week was mentioned, well, what does this do for the person filing the old process of using paper and pen or whatever? It we provide both methods, but we're trying to achieve potential long-term efficiencies by being able to increase the number that are filed electronically. Number 12 is percent of OSHA employer consultations where consultant works actively with a safety committee. And the bottom line interest here is achieving self-sufficiency, a partnership with the industry, and the fact that we do require employers with 10 or more employers in Oregon to have safety committees, and so we want to ensure the viability of those committees. And by having our consultants make contact with those committees when they're doing a consultation, we can better improve the self-sufficiency and the state of safety in our Oregon businesses. Number 13 is the percent of building permits issued that can be used by contractors in multiple jurisdictions for minor construction. And this particular measure is one where we have requested a modification as well. But bottom line, we often refer to these as minor label permits, and they are used and available in multiple jurisdictions, and we feel that it streamlines the process for business and makes it easier to do business in Oregon. When we first initially set this performance measure up, we thought, gosh, why can't we just measure the amount of revenue coming in from minor label permits to the amount of revenue of all permits issued? And it seemed sensible enough to us at the time, but then when we started analyzing the data, we found that the amount of revenue for permits other than minor label is significantly more, and it isn't a good comparator. And so what we're trying to do now is request a modification, so this is the number of building permits issued that can be used by contractors in multiple jurisdictions for minor construction work, so that we can actually focus in on this particular product. And what we set as a standard is an increase in the issuance of those permits of 5% a year. The measure number 14 is very similar, but kind of another edge to measure number 2, which was the wage recovery for workers who injured workers who use the return to work programs. This is asking what the difference in percentage of eligible workers who return to work using return to work programs from those who do not. And as you can see, the last available data in 2000 was 10 points. Our latest data that wasn't available at the time this was printed is now 11-point spread. So it shows that workers who use the return-to-work program at 13 quarters past the date of injury. Oh, I'm giving data for 15. I'm sorry.
Did you finish up 15?
Yeah, I'll finish up 15. So it shows that difference. Number 14, and people will help me learn how to count when I get back tonight, I'm sure, is the percent of workers' benefit fund expenditures determined to be eligible. And in this particular one, we're also asking for a modification, and it's merely to clarify, it will not actually change the data. But what we want to do is make sure that we are clear in our communication to insurers and employers when we're communicating the different benefit programs that are available in the workers' compensation program, that guidance is clear enough that they can achieve refund or repayment for those benefits out of the workers' benefit fund. And most of these are paid by insurers and then reimbursed to the insurer. And so we were afraid that this might be viewed as the actual number of dollars, when what we're actually looking at is discreetly the number of requests for reimbursement. And so our request for modification is that it actually read that percent of workers' benefit fund expenditure requests determined to be eligible. It will not change the data element at all. So I apologize for jumping back over 15 now and going to 16, but 16 is the percentage of permanent rules developed with stakeholder input. When we developed this measure, this was an issue of being accountable to Oregonians and providing excellent customer service. And we also think the outcome of our decision-making is better if we involve stakeholders. So we strive for a high participation in our rulemaking processes to achieve that interest.
Really quick, mm-hmm. Share with us on 16, how can you couldn't have 100%?
Mr. Chair, we actually do. It's a composite measure, and in a number of areas, we do have 100% participation. In some other areas, it was more of an issue of data quality. when we started asking that very question when we were working, we said, well, what are the standards you're applying? You know, what we're trying to do is make sure that we are contacting our stakeholders when we have a rulemaking. And there was a certain level of confusion on whether that meant you had to have an advisory committee, a rulemaking advisory committee in place, or whether you needed to make contact with stakeholders to explain what we were doing and query for their feedback. And once we got that clarified, we've actually increased our performance in this area considerably.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. This measure and the very fact it exists, I guess, speaks to me about one of the functions that the Office of Streamlining and Regulatory Control, forgive me for getting it wrong, ought to do. I mean, to me, it seems keeping track of a performance measure that for some of us who were activists before we became legislators, keeping track of a performance measure that says we involve Oregonians before we promulgate rules strikes me as just a no-brainer. This ought to be absolutely required in every agency. And but maybe this is more of a statement than a question, but it just seems to me to be kind of an odd thing to be tracking. And like the old question, when did you quit beating your wife? Well, what agencies aren't involving stakeholders before they promulgate rules is what it begs to me.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we agree with you, and we've actually wondered, should we just drop this measure? Because what we really want is to get a mindset. And when we've achieved the mindset, we don't need to measure year by year anymore. We didn't propose dropping it because we thought it would send the wrong signal, frankly. One of the issues is every agency has a series of housekeeping rules. And it's easy to say, oh, well, that's housekeeping. I don't want to bother the stakeholders. I don't want to take their time with an advisory group. It's a no-brainer. On the other hand, what we've said instead is, you know what, why don't you call them and ask them whether they agree with you on that? And so achieving 100% stakeholder involvement is something that should be normal course of business.
But this seems to be just a clarion call for helping agencies understand there are procedures. You shouldn't have a plethora of different approaches to rulemaking. I mean, certainly they're going to be nuanced and they will be different, but advisory boards, notice to affected parties, those seem to me to transcend agencies and just be part of a responsible citizen engagement initiative on the part of the state.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, actually one of the things that we're trying to do in the Office of Regulatory Streamlining is improve that process, not because it's not happening. I think most agencies, probably all agencies, are very focused on stakeholder input. But, for example, one of the legislative proposals that you will see floating around, House Bill 2188, will strongly encourage agencies to use that stakeholder involvement process to get the economic impact on business identified at a much earlier stage in the process. So there's always room for improvement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Malocasian again. The next measure is measure number 17, and it has a lot of the attributes of the issues surrounding it is measure 16. It's the percent of cases closed that use alternative dispute resolution. And this was another measure that initially we thought this is a common sense issue. We as a regulator should be always open to looking at alternative ways of resolving disputes and take advantage of the alternative dispute resolution process. And so we do have a very high rate of participation where we actually offer alternative dispute resolution as an option through the process of various cases. But we also wanted to be very careful that we were not sending the wrong message that if you have a very significant, egregious issue with a party that's in violation, that we don't settle just to have to meet a certain number on this particular performance measure. So it's one that we're looking at. Is there a better way of approaching this? Or, as Corey was stating earlier, have we achieved that level of saturation within our culture that it is an option that every one of our employees are considering that are involved in an issue like this? And then finally, measure number 18 is the number of Oregon-specific building code modifications made to the national code. This was another one that turned out to be very interesting. It, our initial take on this was that, if we didn't have Oregon-specific modifications, it would make it very easy for businesses to do business in Oregon, where they're coming into or going across state lines to do business. And so we were actually very aggressive and pursuing this measure, and it didn't take us long to realize that there are some important Oregon-specific modifications. But as you can see from our performance in this measure, and Mark brought this up the other day, where we dropped from 1,401 modifications in 2003 to 1,001 modifications in 2004, that it's a significant improvement. There is one area, just to bring your attention to the data here, is that this code adoption is on a three-year process, so you have a tendency to see the same number for a number of years and then a reduction. So that concludes the overview of the performance measures. If there aren't any questions, the other thing we were going to move into was the priority document.
I think we're going to hold priorities till first thing tomorrow. I have to share with you, Corey and Greg, I think we're going to need to work with Robin and any members of this committee to go through these performance measures through truly no fault of your own. Part of our challenge is to determine the priorities within this committee, and I don't feel I just don't feel well prepared based on these performance measures to determine how those priorities play out. I almost feel like we have sent you on an exercise to give us numbers, just to give us numbers, and I'm concerned about that. So, and again, that's not no fault of your own. I think that part of that is not just not understanding how this works through.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I was just going to add to that that it's maybe this comes up in the next phase when we look at it more specifically, but it's difficult to know what the number actually means and whether or not it means you're achieving something good or falling short. Even when you've got an industry standard or a national standard, that's based on some other criteria that's completely foreign to us. And so when you show a 93% compliance number, I don't know if that's 4% under what it should be or if it's 8% over what it should be. So a qualitative analysis in addition to the quantitative one is probably helpful at some point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, through no fault of any of the agencies,
exactly.
We're being asked now to look at this more from an outcome perspective as opposed to and more of a systemic outcome perspective than agencies ever were involved in when they were assisted in developing performance measures, and that is a challenge.
And I think we're just going to have to work through it as agency and committee and work through this and try and come to a resolution. It's new, and so it's going to be a little bit challenging, but we'll get through it. So. Any other questions, any other comments? Tomorrow we'll go over the priorities, and then on Wednesday we'll begin housing. So that's it.
Thank you.